Some had been heroes, some weaklings, knaves, or cravens. Most were only men, quicker and stronger than most, more skilled with sword and shield, but still prey to pride, ambition, lust, love, anger, jealousy, greed for gold, hunger for power, and all the other failings that afflicted lesser mortals. The best of them overcame their flaws, did their duty, and died with swords in their hands. The worst were those who played the Game of Thrones. Welcome to 2C1C, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast founded in 2010 by myself, Will Lentz, Greg Atkinson, and Brett Zeiler. Now hosted by myself, Daryl Lloyd, and Kyle Vansel, with guest appearances by past hosts and more. Many thanks to George R. R. Martin and Fantasy Flight Games for making this possible, Card Game DB for our hosting, Josh Woodward for this CC licensed music, and you, our listeners, for making it all worthwhile. This is Season 4.5.
All right. That's from...
Where's that from?
Bastards.
Like, what is that in reference to?
The wiki of Song of Ice and Fire says this is from The Queen's Guard.
Hmm. Interesting.
So, yeah, this was, I guess, evidently one of the titled chapters. I don't recall which book that would be in, probably 4 or 5. So, I need to reread those.
Me too.
Yeah, apparently. I mean, it's a good quote. I like it. I was unsure as to where it came from.
Yeah. I thought it was pretty cool. So here we are again with yet another episode of Two Champs and a Chump. One that is recording without an FAQ. But you know what we do have?
What?
Our regular cast. Myself, Will Lentz / Kennan.
Daryl James Lloyd. Gearhalt.
And
on the boards.
And I'm still Kyle.
Who needs to post more regularly on the boards?
Well, I am.
You are?
I'm... He's not. I'm closing in on 100 posts.
Nice.
There's like people who have like 1,500. I'm closing in on 100.
Yeah, I think I've got a little over 1,100. I counted it up. I've dropped some in the top 10 ranking on Card Game DB. I've dropped out of the number 9 spot from a few months ago down to number 13. So I think I really need to step up my game.
I'd say
yeah,
so.
Yeah, well, Jesus.
Come on, man.
Yeah. The problem is I'm not sure that actually counts like comments on articles on the front page. So I think that'd push my count higher if it did.
Oh, well.
But I don't know.
I don't know. I'll have you know that I've been a member of Robotech.com since 2006.
That's impressive.
And I've only posted once on there.
Wow.
That's right. So Card Game DB, I've posted more than anything ever. And I still go to that website sometimes. Why? I have no idea.
Robotech or Card Game DB?
Robotech.com.
Oh, okay.
It gives you points. Okay, I'll tell you why I think it is. Because it gives you points for logging in every day. Like, every day you log in. And so, like, you gain ranks. Like, you become, like, a private, you know, and then, like, a major? A sergeant. A sergeant and then, like, a major. Anyways, unfortunately, I am still a private. But I have, like, 400 points. That's, like, 400 days of logging in.
Very nice.
Yeah.
In 8 years, you've logged in 400 times?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, these numbers don't seem as...
It's not so impressive when you put it that way.
Yeah,
really not.
I mean, there's 365 days in 1 year. I mean, that's nearly right there.
Yeah, well, you also get points for, like, doing trivia on there, which I've done a fair amount of trivia, because I love Robotech. That's actually where the majority of my points have come from. So, really, I probably logged in a lot less than 400 times. So, Yeah. I have a commitment problem. And I'm sorry.
Don't let Robin hear you say that.
only with websites. It's just hard to get into something. I don't know.
It does take a lot of time to really stay up on that stuff.
It does. The trivia is kind of cool. I don't know if we could implement something like that for Card Game DB. It probably doesn't really have a place, but it is fun. It is fun to answer, trivia. Maybe you put a complicated rules question up on there or something. And what's the correct answer? Or even worse, those ones that's all of these are right. Which one's the most right?
Oh, that's terrible. But, the Quill and Tankard regulars guys do that sometimes in their articles. So, there's a little bit of that rules trivia type stuff. They're pretty cool.
Yeah, it's fun. Anywho.
So, yeah, we are still without an FAQ at the time of this recording, and unfortunately, we just could not wait any longer this week and still get recording and editing in time for Friday's release. So, hopefully, in some ways, I think, at least, hopefully you'll have an FAQ by the time you listen to this episode, which, of course, means we'll be way delayed in our response to it.
Yeah. I was going to say, hopefully you wouldn't have an FAQ by the time you're listening to this.
Yeah. Hopefully it comes out next Tuesday, at the prime time for us to be able to record. But we'll see. But what we do have?
What?
Aside from our regular hosts, as I said, we did get an article announcing the final chapter pack in the current cycle, Conquest and Defiance cycle. This pack is called A Dire Message. And we had some kind of cool stuff spoiled there. Had some nice cards. Do you guys have that article up in front of you?
Oh, of course.
Okay, good. Then Daryl,
I don't.
There's one of these cards in the fan there that we can see all of the text of. Why don't you lay that sucker on us?
All right. It is an event. It is called Locked in a Cell. It is House Martell only with prized 2. It reads, any phase, Neil 3 influence, or Neil a Noble Crest character to choose a character without a crest, return that character to its owner's hand. That is a potent effect.
It is.
Now, just really quickly, I will say that, having played a few games now and having a prized event go off a couple of times in those games, prize 2 is pretty hefty.
It is, yeah. It's pretty hefty. That with You Murdered Your Children.
Yeah, and now with seeing a card like this, it actually doesn't give me any hope that Game of Savas is going to be pulled off the restricted list. I realize that Game of Savas is a challenge action. This is kind of any phase, but if I could choose between the two, I would choose Game of Savas. It's a little more situational, but. Still, anytime you can get returned to hand, that is very nice.
Yeah. It strikes me as very interesting. This is effectively a reprint of a CCG era card called Locked in the Tower that just didn't have the prized 2 tagged onto it. And it just seems interesting to me that we've already seen things like Counterplot and You Murdered Your Children, which are effectively CCG reprints with prized added to them, but they kept the same title. So I'm just kind of bemused at why Locked in the Tower became Locked in a Cell. I don't know. Locked in the Tower seems slightly more evocative of the story to me.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you.
I don't know. Just interesting.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. We really can't tell what the rest of these cards are here.
Yeah.
You can sort of tell the Orkwood dude, Raider from Orkwood.
Yeah, he looks, because you can see participating in a challenge, characters more than one icon do not count their strength. So he looks to be some sort of counterpart to the Martell, the, what was it, Spy from Starfall that we got that just made characters with more than one icon knock out their strength. So I think he's probably a counterpart. Flame and Shadow looks interesting because I see take control and non-army character on it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So that seems very interesting.
I mean, we could probably tell what all of that says. I don't know if it's going to be any phase or what, but for the most part, you know, kneel to influence to take control of a non-army character controlled by your opponent, right?
Well, we can see kneel to influence
without attachments.
Something non-army character. We can see the end of something that's probably attachments, and then take control of until end of the
phase.
Yeah, probably phase. Yeah. Which, regardless of whatever phase that happens in, is probably a pretty powerful effect.
I mean, that could be fat for. If it's any phase, or heck, if it's challenge phase, just to pop it out of nowhere, use their dude as claim. Could that work? Like, they military challenge you or something with a dude, you take control of him, and then use him for claim against military challenge he was a part of? Or would he jump out of that?
He would fall out of it if Flame and Shadow is any phase or challenges, then yeah. And interestingly enough, if they were attacking with only one character, and you could take that character, the challenge immediately fizzles.
It does? He's not just considered still being in the challenge?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he falls out. If control changes mid-challenge, the character drops out of the challenge.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But it is priced.
And I said immediately fizzles. I did kind of misspeak there. You could go ahead and have a defender in the challenge and then pull them out, and then you could win. But yeah, as long as that character is currently the only participating character, then it would fizzle when you pull them out.
Man, I don't know how I feel about. Yeah, I was gonna say I don't know how I feel about an event like this.
Yeah, well, let's see. We can't quite see the whole text, so
it's true.
It's hard to say for sure. And then we've got that Cell Galley, which seems to say something about returning characters with naval enhancements to your hand. So I'm not exactly sure what's going on there.
Something in your discard pile for a something enhancement. A character with an enhancement, probably.
Yeah.
And play it as if it was.
No, I see add. It says add it to your hand.
And shuffle and then, your deck if it was.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, something like that. Shuffle your deck if it was searched. I don't know. But we get full spoilers on some other cards down here that I think seem pretty cool. Did you get those open there, Kyle?
No, one second. It's being, you know.
Is your internet being jank?
The wonders of technology.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Will, do you want to at least read the first guy there?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and lay him on us. That would be the Northern Clansman. He's a Stark character. 2 cost, 2 strength, military and power icons. He's a bannerman and, kind of interestingly, a clansman. And if you control a Baratheon character, Northern Clansman gains renown. And if you control a Lannister character, Northern Clansman gains stealth. I think that sounds pretty sweet. I'm pretty excited for the chance to do more cross-house stuff. I always have big fun with splashing, and the fact that he has that clansman trait, I think, probably opens up some kind of fun stuff.
Yeah, I'll agree. I mean, this is a perfect way to, you come out with the conquest agenda, and to kind of spur that on, you make characters that key off of having not necessarily a house card in particular, but just having one of those other characters in play or maybe if you get like a dual house affiliated character or something like that, really opens up some possibilities. And I love the idea of running multiple characters from different factions and things like that. So I'm all about this card.
Good point about the dual house.
It's going to be really fun.
So you could be running like Stark Conquest of Lannister or something. Get a couple of Lannister characters thanks to Conquest. But then on the Stark side, you could be running some of the dual house Stark Barra stuff like Brienne or the Bard, the Wildling Bard and stuff, and activate both halves of the Northern Clansman's ability. I think I would be willing to pay 2 gold for a 2-strength stealthy renown bicon.
Stealth renown? Absolutely. Yeah. Or heck, you could just run 1 Marjorie or Arrogant Contender.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. What? I hadn't thought enough on the Lannister side. Dual House Lannister Baratheon would activate it too. Yeah.
Yep. There's gonna be this looks like a lot of fun. So if hopefully this is testament to just a whole slew of cool characters we're gonna get to see that key off of that. I like that.
Yeah. Speaking of those similar characters, did you get it up, Kyle, or are you still having trouble with that?
That's what she said.
I do have it up. I think I have the next one ready to go.
Okay.
So the next one, kind of continuing with that theme, and I think, like you said, this touches on kind of something that I think is going to be throughout, is a lot of splashing other houses in your deck. We have a 2-for-2 military power bannerman by the name of Dragon Ambassador. And he says, if you control a Greyjoy character, he gains deadly. If you control a Martell character, he gains an intrigue icon. So, that's an interesting play there.
Yeah.
Houses you may not necessarily think of being with Targ, Greyjoy, and Martell.
I kind of think of Martell with the books. Not so much Greyjoy, you know.
Not so much Greyjoy, but... definitely gives you more incentive to do some stuff, especially with like Meraxes being a warship and all. There's possibilities. Yeah.
That would be an interesting. Yeah, that's the thing I really love about Conquest, is it's opening up just so many possibilities and stuff that maybe at first blush you don't think of as having some synergy. Maybe some of these, and it is non-unique, so you can run 3 of them. That bridge to bring about some neat, cool concepts.
Absolutely, and let's not even forget about the possibilities of draft. I mean...
Yeah, if they refresh the draft pool at some point and include some of these guys, there's lots of fun to be had there.
Oh yeah, but for a long time, I've been considering making a cube, and so why wouldn't you add, all those type of characters that key off of having those different houses into that cube. That just seems like a blast. A lot of times with the cube, you're going to put in like the most powerful stuff. I get that, but also I think stuff that keys off of having those other characters in place, it just seems like a blast.
Yeah. I mean, it's something to just kind of help round out any sort of draft environment. You still have to have some chuds to really make it work.
Yeah.
And then we get kind of a strange little cycle here. We get these 3 plots spoiled that all work the same way, but for different houses. Shall we each take one of them?
Yeah, that's fine.
And then talk about them as a whole, perhaps?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, Daryl, lay one on us.
All right, first one is A Task in the East. It is a 3/5/1. It says, when revealed, if you have a Targaryen house card, search your deck for a Martell card. If you have a Martell house card, search your deck for a Greyjoy card. Reveal and add that card to your hand and shuffle your deck.
Kyle, lay the next one on us.
I have a Task for the King, 3/5/1. We have a Lanny house card, we're looking for Barra. We have a Barra house card, we're looking for Stark. I think that's it. Yep. Okay. Reveal and add that card to your hand.
Yep, and the last one is the Turncloak's Task, a 3/5/1. When revealed, if you have a Stark house card, search for a Lannister, or if you have a Greyjoy house card, search for a Targaryen. This is interesting. Does it seem kind of weird to you guys, since it's essentially the exact same effect for all of these plots, to not have, I don't know, what, one single plot that said just search for something that's not your house card?
Hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a little too strong. I mean, we're seeing a lot of combo decks and some quirky things come out with Summoned, and that's just a character. You make it to a card, I think you just open up a world of infant win crap. comes into play and becomes a concern. And you have to remember, I think these houses were picked because they, at first blush, are not things deck building wise that you see necessarily coming together. I mean, we did touch on Greyjoy does gain Meraxes working with Targ. That could be kind of cool. I'd run this plot out of Greyjoy to go grab Meraxes. That'd be awesome.
That'd be pretty decent.
Yeah. Yeah, I think. I think that the creation of these plots, I feel like they're trying to give you an incentive to run Conquest and, you know, kind of. But at the same time, I think they want to have a kind of a pressure valve. Like, they're trying to balance it in some way as well. Just, you know, make just. I mean, I guess they could have made a plot that says search your deck for an out of house card, a non-neutral out of house card or whatever, and then make it like price two. But, I mean, I don't know. I'm all right with it. I mean, the more plots, the better. More cards to look at, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, they're all pretty cool, good stats. And, yeah, Kyle's right. I hadn't thought too much about it till he mentioned the different house pairings, but things like a Martell house card searching for a Greyjoy card, that's not a pairing that you see in the game right now. So, yeah, this could encourage some different stuff. And welcome to a bit of a special segment for Two Champs and a Chump that we've been attempting or planning to attempt for quite some time now, but the logistics involved are unique, shall we say, when you're trying to get these disparate parties involved. This week, we have some special guests here to help us with a rules segment that I wanted to do. Not necessarily a particular thing for the topic here, but kind of a round table. We want to talk a little bit about some confusions that arise, what might call that, what caused that, rather, what could be streamlined to improve things, maybe some thoughts on what should go. So joining me here today, I think, are some familiar, at least one familiar voice to some of our listeners, and certainly a couple familiar internet monikers from our friendly rivalry with Beyond the Wall. We have Mr. Alex Hines, also known as Istaril. I always forget where the emphasis is.
I've gone with Istaril, but once it's on the internet, the pronunciation's in the hand of the of whoever reads it.
Speaking of pronunciations, I think I may stick with board names here for our European guests, in the interest of me not completely butchering their names. We have W.W. Drakey and Iyer.
Hey, yeah.
Hello.
Yeah, for clarification of the listeners, so we can keep track of who's who, Drakey, would you say hello?
Yes, gladly.
All right, hello. And Iyer.
Hello, I'm Iyer.
They're basically interchangeable, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Well, I'm the master and he's the Padawan, I think so.
You're sure you're not the Sith Lord and he's your apprentice?
Well, yeah, that's more like it, I think.
Okay, well, we'll just kind of open things up. I did have a couple questions to kind of help direct some conversation here, but I know some of the guys had made a few notes of their own. So maybe we'll kind of open things up with an open-ended question here. And I have a suspicion of what Alex might say in answer to this question, but maybe we'll start with a zoomed in view here on particular cards, and we'll move out from there later. But is there any particular cards that you guys find extremely, you know, problematic in the current rules system?
I've got to jump in on that one, and I'm fairly certain that that we're going to be talking about the same one. I think that any card that specifically needed an FAQ entry or multiple FAQ entries to tell us how it worked, and not just errata and things like that, but specific rules to address how it works. That's cards like Call of the Three-Eyed Crow. Those are cards that should not exist.
I figured that would be the card that came to your mind immediately there.
I think Call of the Three-Eyed Crow is pretty much a byword for completely messed up in a way that it's really hard to understand what the hell it does, actually.
Yeah, Daryl played that card against me a few weeks ago, actually, when we were initially planning this episode, and he said something about doing whatever it was with it, and I was like, well, no, it actually kind of happens this way, only that's not quite right, and I was doing a poor job of explaining it, so I was telling him, just hang on till we get these guys on. And, for my sake, Daryl's sake, the listener's sake, would someone please tell me exactly what that card really does? Or doesn't do, for that matter?
Well, as okay, written, it doesn't work.
There is that.
Yes. Well, what it attempts to do somehow, I think at least what we come to understand that it does, is it's kind of a replacement effect, similar to Retreat, for example. But what it would do is change a card from leaving play to a secondary moribund state, which would be moribund returning to play. I think that's the closest we've ever gotten to really understanding it. So
yeah,
go ahead.
This is exactly if you read the card at first glance, generally you have a pretty good idea of what it should be doing. And then you look at it a little bit deeper and you realize that, hold on, it doesn't use an instead, it doesn't use a replacement effect. So it's taking a card that's moribund and can't affect it at all. It's also written as a response after something enters your dead pile, which confuses people because most of these are written as after something is killed. So that, again, further complicates the timing. It's not inherently a problem within the timing structure, but every time you take another look at this card, you feel like tearing it up.
Yeah, because I was trying to explain to Daryl, because the way I had kind of understood it from following things you guys have said and clarified for people online, is when you change that moribund state, let's say you have the Blackfish out with the Crown of Winter on him, let's say, one of my favorite things to have, and he dies and you're trying to use this on him, he never physically leaves play now, right? But because of the moribund state he was in and then the change, the attachment still becomes moribund discard and still is discarded, right?
Yeah, that happens in the passive step. Step 4, and this is responding in step 5.
And would he still lose power as well then?
But that's the problem, yeah. He actually would also lose power, I think, according to what's been heard from FFG.
Yeah, I think that's a real sticking point for a lot of people, that, like, this card never leaves play, but somehow everything on it does leave.
Yeah, I think it's kind of fishy, because I think the wording that, because it says when a card enters your dead pile, because you can also trigger it in a very different scenario. When you're moving something from an out of play state to the dead pile, you can also then trigger the effect, putting the card into play from that. So basically, if you have a Visenya's Hill, which is moving something to discard to dead pile, you can also trigger Call of the Three-Eyed Crow there, moving it from the dead pile into play, into moribund return to play, which is kind of ridiculous in a way.
Well, aside from Call of the Three-Eyed Crow, unless you guys had any parting thoughts on it, is there anything else?
I think one thing I would like to say about this is that replacement effects are have so far been one of the best template things. There's the magical word instead. If the word instead is somewhere in the card, you know it's a replacement effect. So you understand that it can change the moribund state and so forth. The Cloth-Triad Crow is basically a replacement effect without the word instead, but informed from FFG that it is one still, which breaks the pattern, which I think is a bad thing there, the worst thing, in a way, because it puts up a much more suspicion on cards. How can you identify a replacement effect after that anymore?
You know, oh, sorry, were you about to say something?
No.
Oh, okay, I saw you pop up there.
It's not only that, which is one of the problems because the templating is inconsistent, but it's the fact that this creates a whole new set of rules. Not just because the templating is inconsistent, but it's now created this moribund to play, or moribund to play knelt, or moribund return to play that we can't really quantify, and that is really counterintuitive when you're thinking of moribund as the state of leaving play.
Right.
Indeed.
Well, gosh, that leads the potential conversation in a couple different directions here that I did want to tackle. I think probably the closer connection of the moment, though, would be Moribund itself. I kind of wanted to get your input on that, guys. I don't think any of you were actually playing in the early dawn Stone Age of the CCG era, right?
No, unfortunately not.
Okay. Nope. Well, to put that in context, the reason why I bring it up is the game did not debut with Moribund as a concept. And it was eventually added, I think, a couple years into the game in order to kind of clarify some things and allow for situations that are possible now which were not possible at the time, like, say, you've already chosen to kill a Lannisport moneylender for claim, and then while they're moribund, kneel them for the cost of a Lannister pays his debts. So I'm just kind of curious, it may be difficult to address if you didn't play in the prior period, which is a very long time ago even for me now. But I'm curious what you think of Moribund as a whole. Is it a good thing? Do you think it probably solves more questions than it creates? Or does it wind up being too tough of a topic or a concept for newer folks to grasp when they're getting into the game?
I think that basically sums it up. The Moribund state is there to allow very specific interactions. For instance, Deadly becomes less powerful because your card is Moribund and you're not necessarily losing another character from Claim and Deadly. King Joffrey, or one of the early versions of Joffrey that can trigger off a lord dying, can now trigger off himself dying and win you the game. There are a lot of cases in which it happens, but it's fairly limited in its impact on the whole game. And I think that's really one of the reasons why it's really, I would say that Moribund is unnecessary. I think it's unnecessarily complicated, and it's typically one of the first barriers when explaining the game and starting to work through the timing structure that comes up. Now, it's very well described in the FAQ. It's very well detailed. So eventually, once you work your way through it, this templating sort of becomes second nature to some of us. But that doesn't really justify its existence, at least not to me.
Yeah, I think many new players simply play the game without ever really understanding that it exists at all. But they don't really see what's happening there. They just think that they're triggering something to the discard pile or dead pile, or think that it's just somehow the timing is going differently, and don't really see that it even existing there at all. And once you start explaining it to them during a game or something, they get completely confused, usually.
Unfortunately, I think it's ingrained into the game at this point. There are too many effects that only work from the Moribund state for it to be something they could easily reverse.
Aside from Call of the Three-Eyed Crow, what sort of effects are you thinking of there, Alex?
what specific things, anything on a character that triggers after that character is killed. And which there are a couple. So there's Quentin, who allows you to draw or to get some power, and then there's one of the No Agenda Knights, which allows you to draw cards. None of those would work.
Okay.
I think Cersei's Attendant would be one as well. But I also play Call of Cthulhu a bit,
mm-hmm.
and there they don't have a Moribund, but they just have in the rules a portion which dictates that you can trigger responses from a card just left play, even if it were in play still. So basically, it has the same thing. They have the responses, or the leaves play responses, but they're just triggered from the discard or dead pile instead of being triggered from play.
Oh, okay. I dabble in Call of Cthulhu, but I never realized that particular distinction in the way they worked.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting for me as well when I noticed it, because it pretty much solves the same issue, but it's, in a way, cleaner, I think.
As far as other directions to head here, is there anything then, aside from that, that you guys find unclean or messy in the rules right now? I think that probably opens up a wide range of potential topics.
Yeah, but maybe playing off what was just mentioned, Call of Cthulhu, the other LCGs in general, you can see that Thrones is somewhat bound by a templating that dates back now almost 10 years. Even though they did have a small chance to reboot it, they still had to stay within some of the same structure. Because FFG certainly has improved some of the things that I would bring up right now, things like the difference between a save-cancel response and a response. In almost all of these games now, it's in Star Wars, and it looks like in the new 40K LCG from the template, that those are framed as interrupts versus responses. And that's something that can clarify the timing and make sure that you know the timing is distinct without breaking the game.
Yeah, I think that complicates things for newer players when they don't know if a card is necessary save or cancel response, since it's only always response, and then it's cancel or save in there.
A similar consideration is one of the templating things I despise, which is the words initiate or activate or trigger, which are very inconsistently used in the Game of Thrones game, but are really quite improved in some of these other LCGs now that they've managed to build up on that. Instead of having all these passives, they tend to have forced reactions and things like that, where the templating is much more consistent.
Yeah, I've kind of wondered to myself if that's possibly something that gets FFG in the largest amount of trouble, is templating in general. There doesn't seem to be, even just within Game of Thrones, that strong consistency of templating. You know, one wording on a card uses this three or four word phrase, the next one substitutes what are English language synonyms, but in the game rules potentially could have different context. I just keep wondering if that isn't one of the biggest hurdles in clarity, is that there's not just consistency in the wording.
Yeah, I would really agree with that, because the consistency is needed so that the interpretation becomes easy and more routine. And then, of course, there's something else that they aren't doing much, which is codifying stuff into keywords enough. For example, I think the no agenda stuff could be easily codified into a keyword, which basically said, let's say, an agendaless keyword. And we can just define that if the character has agendaless, then it doesn't have its card text if you're running an agenda and stuff like that. So instead of having these huge text boxes which state something like, if you are not running an agenda, Alaris gains, blah, blah, blah. Or if you are running a non-character agenda, treat surgery string, what is printed text box as if it, blah, blah, blah. And so there's a huge amount of text on the cards because of this, and they're different with different cards like Alaris, Jerry's, Spreaded Screamers, Fleets, and so forth. But instead you could so easily quantify identify these, codify these into just keywords, and those you can then just define into rules.
I'm torn on that because there's a great advantage to doing that. You use less card space, but also whatever your keyword means, you can change it by changing the rules. So, for instance, if one day you're really unhappy with the way Deadly works because there's more and more changes of controlling characters, you could eventually someday go back and change the core rules for Deadly without having to reprint cards. So in that sense, I think that codifying things into keywords is very, very good. In the sense of introducing new players to the game, I think they're terrible. I mean, one of the frequent questions I get is, you know, what does Deadly do again? What does Stealth do again? And this is just a fairly limited set of rules that we have. The larger that gets, I think, the more problematic it is.
Well, actually, many games have found a way to work around that. That the first time you start introducing cards with a new keyword, they have this italic text, or if there's room on the card for having it, to have this italic text in parentheses behind the keyword, which explains what it does. So when, for example, I think The Legend of the Five Rings has done this, and Magic has done this as well. So when you have this new keyword and you're introducing it, you have these parentheses which explain what it does in very short sentences.
Yeah, I've always wondered. Oh, go ahead, Art.
Even for LCTs, I think Star Wars is doing it now.
Actually, I was looking at the 40K preview article, I think, because I was just reading it before we started recording, and I noticed the same thing. They have this area effect, and then that's clearly some sort of keyword, and there's a really short italics version of the entire ruling. But while I can see that being advantageous for teaching new players, doesn't that then force you to never be able to change that rule in the same way that writing it down does? I mean, it helps with templating. Your templating is going to be consistent, so I guess it's a bit of a win.
Yeah, and, you know, still helps with the new player grokking. So you could potentially have the reminder text on, say, Shadow Cat. You could have the reminder text for Stealth because there's not really anything else relevant in that text box beyond flavor text. And then leave that off and save the space on, say, the new Shadow's Littlefinger, where you need that text box space on something else. But, as you know, as long as people still play with a variety of cards and the ones with the reminder text pop up fairly often, then it's available for newer players. So, you know, between that and the inability to change it wholesale by errata, yeah, I don't know. I guess maybe you're kind of stuck on one front no matter what you do.
Says something that in their more recent games, they've chosen to go that route. I think, again, this is a case where they're constrained by older templating to some extent. And if they really could reboot this or launch a new core rulebook, they would like to. It's just whether that's feasible or not.
Yeah, because it's so much easier to just read a card and see a keyword and you know what it does, if you're familiar with the keyword at that point. Instead, if you get a new card, which, say we got Alerus last cycle, you have to read the full text to see if it's a Cherries or if it's something slightly different, if there's a minor change in between, which may completely change how it works, and so forth. So we always have to read the cards through, instead of just quickly glancing and seeing, okay, this is an agendaless card, that would be okay.
You know, and that bringing up Alerus again makes me wonder, because you mentioned the differences in the wording on Alerus and the unique knights in Martell and, you know, the fleets and different things like that that don't all work quite the same way. I wonder, you know, it's hard not being able to say for sure, since I'm not the designer, whether all of those are very specifically worded differently on purpose, or if that is again a templating issue, you know, internally, where they were kind of, shall we say, lackadaisical, and the idea is the same everywhere but didn't get written down the same. How to wrap up that thought where I'm going is tough here.
I think I can wrap it up with a completely unrelated card that makes the point. A card like King's Landing Drummond, where the templating got so distorted that nobody knows what the card does. I think that it's much more likely that it's a question of templating and that there isn't a consistency. So things are written in English rather than in block forms of Thrones rule text.
Yeah, I think it's a difference in approach. I think Damon at one point mentioned in an interview somewhere that he likes to create cards from scratch, you know, like innovate and sort of artistic approach to the thing. Whereas I would personally think that the more engineer-like approach to cards would be a bit better because it helps a lot with the rules stuff. So coming up with an idea of what it is you want, you would just and just creating a loose text for what it does. I think it should more be done by first getting the idea, then looking at the rules, and then taking the blocks from there, sort of like an engineer taking pieces, so that you get the effect you want with the card.
And I also wonder if changing hands hasn't caused some of these issues too. Since it's such a small design team on FFG's end, it feels like maybe your personal style, like you said there with Damon, can play a bigger role, you know, so you wind up with Eric Lang wording cards one way for the first couple years of the game, you know, and then Casey taking over, Nate taking over, and then Damon, and some of these wordings shift over the years. Just because of how each of those people personally writes.
Yeah, I can see that being a real issue.
Well, I think it's a two-pronged thing. There's clearly the individual person applying it, which causes problems. But there's also, you know, maybe Damon has taken some rules template and said, hold on, we've had lots of questions about this templating of Eric Lang's. Let's redo the templating for these cards that I'm making. Which, in a way, is favorable because you're learning from your mistakes, but in a way is problematic because we've learned how the old ones work, and now there's a new way to phrase it.
Right. Speaking of phrasing, there was something else that I was kind of curious what you guys thought of. And it's related to phrasing and how something is phrased on a couple different cards. And what generally causes a quite a bit of frustration on my end is the new-ish at this point errata and re-release of the formerly banned Jack and Hagar.
Oh no.
Oh yeah.
Oh God, no.
Yeah, I figured this would get awkward. Where, of course, he is errated with new text re-release. But then we get an FAQ entry, and I'm actually speaking of the frequently asked questions section of the FAQ document, that then clarifies a question about how his ability works, which introduces this new concept of qualified keywords. But now we have a ruling that the attachment banner bearer and, you know, other potential effects that work similarly does not work the same way as Jackin does, despite their rules text under the erratum being essentially the same. And I'm kind of curious what you guys think of that problem. Personally, I just find it to be a problem. I mean, an annoyance, of course, to teach people that it works differently. But I think the biggest issue to me is that comes about because of an actual FAQ, like a question clarification. I feel like that should set the like broad strokes of how these situations work. But if you're going to single out a particular card, that should have been an erratum added into Jackin's entry specifically. Am I crazy in thinking there should be a distinction like that? Or that the actual questions set the more broad strokes for rulings?
I have similar issues with the Dreadfort ruling that I don't... You know, I'm one of the people who probably knows the rules among the best for that, and I still don't understand the timing of the Dreadfort ruling and why you get to draw a card and certain other aspects of constant effects and when they actually come into effect. And that's an FAQ entry for a question. I dislike the TR or the Red Viper and Mira Reed FAQ answer, which again sets a rules precedent rather than just clarifying a question. So I'm in the same boat. I think that, first of all, any of these cards that need to be errated, like Call of the Three-Eyed Crow, because they create new rules, are problematic. And second of all, I think you're right. The FAQ should be to clarify some question, not to introduce new rulings.
Yeah, I agree. I think the questions and the answers should kind of give an idea of how you generally interpret things, instead of really being pinpointed to specific cards.
Am I correct here in saying that Jaqen H'ghar and Call of Three-Eyed Crow are the only cards which have their specific FAQ entrance for them? There's only one single card that does it, and they have FAQ for it.
It depends on whether you consider the Mira with the Red Viper interaction specific to it. Although it's not really a ruling change, it's how to interpret Vens. I just don't agree with it.
Right. Did that one affect any, that precedent set there, did that affect any other cards that I'm not thinking of at the moment?
I don't think so.
There's a lot of immune to character abilities cards, so it's not just the Viper.
That's
okay,
true.
Right. So there was some kind of universal groaning when I brought up that Jaqen entry and such. Was it specifically because of that issue, the question versus erratum, or was there something else that you guys had in mind with that situation?
Well, my groan was because the card was re-released and then had to be errated to be unique again, and then needed another FAQ entry to clarify how it worked with immunity keywords, and then needed another rules entry to clarify the definition of qualified keywords, which is essentially you reprint a card and you need three changes to your FAQ because of it, not to mention taking it off the ban list.
Yeah.
You should have just left it on the ban list.
And added the concept of qualified keywords, which is used nowhere else now? That just seems bizarre to me.
It's probably going to be more and more relevant with prized keywords, which look like they're qualified keywords as well. We don't have confirmation of that. But it looks like the number after that is basically a qualifying number.
Okay. So Jaqen could still not do anything in particular with it.
Correct.
But
you can't give Jaqen prize 15 and then lose him and play Infamous or whatever the case is.
Yeah. But you still could do that with a banner.
But that wouldn't help anyway, because Infamous happens afterwards. The other player's already won.
That's right. So. Well, unless he's playing Wild Wild. has a chain on his agenda.
Yeah.
Has the chain on the agenda. That's living the dream right there. Okay. Well, I know you guys had some notes, or at least some of you did. Is there anything in particular anybody wanted to bring up?
I could bring up milling cards.
Okay. What about them?
I could ask a few questions from you.
Okay.
So let's say you're playing Corpse Flag as your House of Dreams location, and then your Drowned Disciple dies.
Mm-hmm.
It reads, if Drowned Disciple would be killed, instead put it on bottom of your deck, then each opponent discards the top three cards of his or her deck. So can you trigger Corpse Flag out of this one?
And Corpse Flag, what was the wording on it again?
If a triggered response, it's not
triggered, it's a triggered effect. One or more characters.
One or more characters from opponent's deck, then claim one power for your house.
Gotcha. Oh, that one's tough. That sort of question came up with one of our newer players here recently, and I thought I'd answered right, but now I feel like I'm on the spot. I'm inclined to say no, because it's a passive with an initiation point, but not triggered with bold text on the disciple, that is.
And you're correct.
Woohoo!
It's a passive, so it's not a triggered effect, so you cannot trigger Corpse Flake out of it. Okay, let's continue. Okay, then we have Iron Fleet Raiders. which reads, any phase, discard the top card of your deck to give Iron Fleet Raiders minus 2 strength. Until the end of the phase, only opponent can trigger this effect. So, what do you say?
Okay, and Corpse Lake just said any triggered effect, right? It didn't.
That's correct.
Okay, it didn't specify whether you or your opponent did the discarding.
As long as it's from your opponent's deck.
Okay. Then I am going to say that, yes, you may trigger Corpse Lake.
And I'm going to say that I actually have no idea, because it's a cost.
Touché.
This is one of those ambiguities with the word effect in the templating, so I am not actually sure, and I would have to check that with K-Tom.
I think go ahead.
And the actual funny thing is that the text box ability ends in only opponent can trigger this effect.
Okay. So yes, that would make you think.
Worse.
Okay. So I stumbled into a correct answer? Is that what I'm getting out of that?
Well, it's still the cost.
Okay, yes. So in the end, it is still the cost, even though it has that reminder text at the end.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think we checked this on the forums at some point, and I think the common understanding would be that since it's a cost, you cannot trigger Corpse Lake.
Yeah, and that would have been my inclination as well. Yeah.
Yes. And there's actually a brilliant story related to Iron Fleet Raiders, because a year ago in the Finnish regionals, we had this one player who had an Iron Fleet Raiders on the table, and another player who was playing Baratheon with a Mithrandir scheme and stuff like that. And we were looking, judging the table with Ire, and then we just understood that at some point that if the Baratheon player would have figured it out, he could have milled his whole deck or as much as he wanted to with Iron Fleet Raiders, since there's nothing stopping you from giving it all the time more minus 2 strength. So you could basically mill as much as you want to get the cards you want in your discard pile to use with Mithrandir scheme. And we were trying to maintain our composure there and managed it quite nicely, and just had to tell the guy who was our friend afterwards, because and he was pretty wrought about that, because he could have probably won the table with it.
Oh no.
Okay, let's go with Theon Greyjoy. This is the one from Where Loyalty Lies. While Theon Greyjoy is in your dead pile, he gains, at the beginning of the dominance phase, discard the top card of each opponent's deck. Can this be used with Corpse Lake?
I'm tempted to... Okay. And it's not a trigger, it's just a passive on there. It's what I get for not opening the card up in front of me. Let's see if I can load him and look at him without ruining the Skype call here. Yes. It's also what I get for searching for Theon. It pulls all of the Baratheons.
Baratheon.
Okay, there we go. I am going to go with no on Corpse Lake. Still
and
looks like a pass.
Correct.
All right.
Okay, let's then go for Raiding the Reach. Response. After you win an unopposed challenge, reveal the top 5 cards of the losing opponent's deck. Choose and discard 2 cards. And put the rest back on top of the deck in any order.
Ooh, see, now that one's tricky. I think that same discard player down here was asking about this that same night. Since Corpse Lake specifically says the top of the deck, I'm going to say that gets real wonky with Raiding the Reach. Let's see. I'm going to go with a tentative no, unless you're tracking which one was literally on the top of the deck and get rid of it. But that's probably real fiddly.
It's actually, yes, since the revealed cards are still discarded from the deck itself.
Okay, so the fact that Corpse Lake literally says top of an opponent's deck, it doesn't matter if that card is 3 cards down or literally the top card?
I guess as long as it wasn't the bottom card.
Huh.
<That's... laughs> I don't know, but that would have been my ruling as well, that this would count, because even though you're revealing them, they're still as part of the top 5 cards of the opponent's deck.
That's interesting. Okay, so top 5 cards is still treated as top, which is one specific place in English. But for a search effect, searching a deck, which is all-inclusive, is different from searching the top five cards, which is a specific amount. That's crazy. To me, anyway. That sounds crazy.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, let's get to the last one, and this one was the one Istaril was waiting for. Okay. So we have, let's say we had the Raiding the Reach, and now we have Mötley Crüeman working with it. Any effect that discards one or more cards from an opponent's deck discards an additional card.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that the Mötley Crüeman modifies the Raiding the Reach itself. And since Raiding the Reach is a trigger that would work, Corpse Lake is still good to go. But if it was modifying, say, Theon from the prior question, it would not be good to go.
Ah, quite good. You're correct on this one.
All right. But yeah, that was
pretty good.
I'm yeah, honestly surprised.
Yeah, because I think the point here was to show that the milling cards are a good example of something where there are cards that you would really want to work together, that seem like they should work together, but and at lots of time they don't because of minor wording inconsistencies, because there's a word triggered there, and then a lot of the miller things are passives, and then you have costs to triggered effects, which aren't part of the triggered effect itself, but costs. And people play these wrong a lot, I think.
Oh, I'm
sure. Isn't there one of the ones that triggers off discarding like a character or an attachment and claiming a power? Doesn't it break when you modify it with Mötley Crüeman? I can't remember which one's which. But isn't there one that says, reveal the top card, if it is a character, claim one power? Or if it is an attachment, and then if you have Mötley Crüeman, then you're revealing the two, and it really starts to confuse things? I might be digging a little bit here.
What card is it?
Maybe the Apostle of the Drowned God?
Yeah, there was that cycle, one for each icon, that
there,
looks
yeah,
for
there
a
you
different
go. So that's
type.
An example. It says, discard the top card of the losing opponent's deck. If that card is a location, Apostle of the Drowned God claims one power.
So why would care, but Corpse Lake doesn't? I mean, if you're looking for just top card.
Oh, because Corpse Lake is if one or more is discarded. So it's not the same problem here where it says, if the card you discard is a location, it claims the power. But if
okay.
I modify Apostle of the Drowned God with the Crüeman, suddenly I don't know if that card is the location.
I see what you're getting at. I had missed, on Corpse Lake, the distinction of or more when I was looking at that. I was far too focused on top.
And I think, while we're in the same vein, it's not actually me who brought this up. I think it was you, Drakey, because we mentioned this whole scenario as being a House of Dreams with Corpse Lake. But you actually had brought something up in the Skype group about House of Dreams and how it's played in general.
I wonder what you're referring to. You might be talking about the cancel thing, maybe?
Well, no, I'm talking specifically about the start of game ritual.
You had a new player asking about that just last night. Do tell me.
So basically the point is that people often play House of Dreams so that they wait and see what their opponent is playing, and then maybe choose their house they're running, the location they're running based on that. But really how the rules would go is you build, before the game even happens, you toss a coin, decide the first player. And then when the first player is decided, he or she will first reveal their house card and agenda. And the way House of Dreams is actually worded, it happens immediately there. So if you're if you get chosen as first player, you shouldn't know what your opponent's house and agenda would be. So you couldn't choose basically what something that opposes it nicely for your location, but rather you'd have to guess beforehand. And people play this wrong a lot if you think about it.
Well, one of the reasons that one really bothers me is because there's so much middle ground at this point. So there's clearly the rules explain how you're supposed to do this, but so few people do. And okay, I'm sure there are a lot of scenarios like that in the rules, but if you're adhering to the rules, at what point are you cheating? So for instance, I'm playing someone in the cut that I already played. I flip a coin, I'm first player, but I'm going to set up my House of Dreams location and pick out Aegon's Hill because I know he's playing Martell Knights of the Hollow Hill. Mm-hmm. That's probably legit, right?
I would say so.
Probably, yeah. Depends on how you came up with the information. That
right, so here it's the rematch and the cut. What happens if I come to my table and he's already revealed his house and agenda and he's shuffling his deck?
Yeah. Well, that is tricky there, as Drakey pointed out about the specific actual rules to the beginning of the game that, I'll be honest, I don't know anybody that I've played with or against that correctly follows. Yeah, if they've already announced the information, I'm not sure I can fault you for using it. Like, you know, for instance, say they play the new Sansa Stark, and they're down on command, and they search for a card, and she does not make you reveal that card, since you can get anything. Well, if, you know, they're not thinking, they're just used to so many of the search effects that make you reveal it, they reveal it anyway. You know, should you pretend that you don't know what that is, or since they revealed it, you know, there's not really a way to undo that?
Yeah, that's a difficult situation in many ways, I think. But I think how many people then again know that how many people know about the beginning ritual of a game? How many people really correctly know it? That's a good question also.
I think very 20, few.
Maybe 30?
Yeah. Basically people are giving away information they wouldn't have to give away because they don't know the rules, and the basic rules of how a game begins. And people don't know those, really. That's also related to why we originally began the whole Quill and Tankers thing, because we were reading tourney reports online, and then there were games that were hinging on people telling us, this is a really close game, and then I triggered it, and this and this. And then you understand, that's not really legal. That you can't do that. And I read several tourney reports from Europe and from the US, I think, in a short time space. It was a regional season, so I was reading those through. And then it meant, oh God, if we're not playing the same game, if everybody isn't playing the same game, then how can we talk about game balance at all? Because if we're not playing the same game, the balance isn't the same either, pretty much.
I totally see what you mean there. While we're kind of related to House of Dreams, though, that same new player had another question about House of Dreams that, you know, I admit I didn't have the FAQ right in front of me at the time. So I told him essential convention there. But House of Dreams just says that you choose this card from your deck. I mean, how is that accomplished? A lot of other types of things I would think would say, search your deck for a, you know, unique, non-limited location, whatever, start with it and play, then shuffle your deck. House of Dreams doesn't really say that. So he didn't really believe that he could just look at the order of his deck, know what it is, and set it back down once he's chosen his location. But is that just kind of convention that we go ahead and shuffle and such, or am I forgetting a ruling?
So this is the moment when everybody gets their FAQ up and starts digging through. And
it's going, it's in the core set rules, so it's even worse.
Oh, it is. Oh, wow.
Yeah, you shuffle your house deck after you declare your house an agenda. It's step 4, so it wouldn't matter. You could look at the entire order of your deck, but you shuffle your house deck after you've declared your house an agenda and before you draw your setup hand.
Okay, that is good to know.
I have a follow-up question.
Okay.
It's using the word choose. Can you fail at choosing?
That is a good question. You can fail at searching. I don't know about choosing.
Actually, you can't fail at searching. That's also one of the funny rules in Game of Thrones.
Really? So
you can't fail if there isn't a legitimate target.
Yes.
So if it's a passive that initiates, yeah.
Yeah. If you can find it, you have to find it. That's also something that's completely impossible to judge in any way, but
yeah.
It's still a rule.
As soon as you said that, I thought, well, what happens if I've already played every maester in my deck and I flip here to serve? Do I have to show my opponent the whole deck so they know that I actually fail?
You'd
what?
Have to call that judge. That's the only way.
Well, you would choose not to, or you would say, I have no maesters or nothing that can be found by the search effect without the gates or whatever. And then if he challenged it, he'd say, I'd want to call a judge over. And you could do the same for manning the city walls, for instance. If he flips manning the city walls and doesn't drop an army, you could call a judge over to make sure he doesn't have an army in hand.
Okay. So related to that, we've had, not in the FAQ yet, but I believe it was an email response from Damon that someone pasted onto one of the various rules boards. Because unfortunately, I forget now exactly which card was at issue in the original email, but I do remember the Damon's response intimated that we would no longer be able to trigger effects that are not expected to have a successful result.
It's the infamous Janus Slint ruling.
Oh, yes,
the
that's what
card.
It was. Yes. So then if I don't have a valid search target, if I already know that I don't have it anymore in the deck, can I no longer trigger that? Say I don't have any more attachments, and I've played the target guy that searches for an attachment if it's summer. I can no longer trigger that?
Correct. Red Warlock, I think. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, what happens if I can't recall if I have an attachment left, I do go ahead and trigger him, then look through my deck, realize that I do not have an attachment. I've just
I
done
think
something
there's
cool.
A black hole. A black hole.
Yeah, that is an oopsie.
I mean, fundamentally, it doesn't really change the game state, except that you'll have shuffled your deck where you were not allowed to. And that can change things. But
yeah, if there's a stalwart card on top or something like that, then it would really change things.
Right. Or you've used a herald or something.
Yeah.
But I think bringing up the rulings there from Damon and the FFG rulings is probably something that we really should talk about. So every once in a while, there's a question sent to FFG, and we get a reversal of a previous ruling, and 80% of the time, we send another follow-up with a slightly different question to make sure they really meant what they said they meant, and it turns out they didn't. The Janus Slint case is not one of those. We asked, that's a reversal of a previous ruling. Is that really what you mean? And they did. But we don't have a codified way to access all of these pre-existing rulings. We're relying on the word of God. We're relying on K-Tom. We're relying on Drakey. We're relying on Ire, on people like these, to tell us what has been ruled previously. The FAQ includes a lot of those rules. But there are times where we're running up against precedents from the CCG, and we have to go to someone like K-Tom, or we have to go to Damon, and we have to go to Nate. And when we do, that doesn't get added to the frequently asked questions, nor should it. It's not a frequently asked question. But, there's no easy way to go back to every official ruling that has been given. And I think that's a problem on their end as well as ours. We don't get access to that information, but they also don't get a chance to say, refer to answer 421 on our table, or something like that.
Perhaps they should start an RAQ. A rarely asked questions list.
But I think it's part of a really fundamental problem because what you really should have as rule sources is the core set rules and the FAQ. And pretty much those two should be enough. Or if there is something else that's needed, it should also be some kind of systematic thing, like knowledge base for cards, something like that. But instead, we also need common interpretations. And a lot of these are from K-Tom, and they're from CCG era rulings. So basically, the old rulings, which K-Tom is basing his new rulings on, which usually are really nicely correct, but they're all sort of word of mouth things only that are on rules boards and so forth. And then we have these emails. And then should TOs really use these emails, which are usually reported by somebody, that I got this email from Damon that says like this, so we start judging differently suddenly. Should we actually use those rulings from emails for attorneys before they're actually codified in some kind of official source? Because now we're using this combination of official sources and kind of unofficial black market sources for rules, and then we combine them together.
It's the tragedy of common law, I think, for those of us in nations where the majority of law is non-codified and comes from pre-existing rulings. It is a nightmare to navigate. I mean, just as an example of something that we all take as common law, there's a lot of things that you wouldn't think about, the way you play events, that are not properly codified. But maybe the one that comes up most often that you have to explain to people is the epic battle phase. Mm-hmm. And whether it has an action phase like the challenges phase, or it doesn't have a player action window before your challenges like you would expect in the later phases like dominance and so on that don't have a player action window before. And that's never stated in the rules. And it's something that almost everybody who plays the game competitively knows.
That it's not stated, or knows the answer?
Well, they know that it's not stated, but they also know the answer. They know that you cannot trigger player action window or anything from a player action window outside of the challenge.
Gotcha.
So challenge initiates, player action window, defenders, player action window, challenge resolves, the end. There's no pre-challenge player action window in the epic battles. And I would say that at a competitive level, that doesn't really, most people are aware of this. But this has never been codified, and it's been a ruling that has been standing for years now.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny you bring up those action windows. It's just been the last few years that it kind of registered for me that difference in just the phases in general. And I've realized that really bugs me, because I can't come up with any real reason for half the phases of the game to have a player action window before whatever the framework action is for the appropriate phase, and then half of them do not. So
then you're in the same boat as the rest of us.
I just wish we would go through and streamline. I mean, it's fine with me personally, one way or the other, whichever way FFG goes, and says, okay, player action window at the start of every phase regardless, or none regardless, but it's this half of one, or, you know, sorry, half a dozen of one, six of the other sort of approach that just is needlessly complicated.
Yeah, because you really should have a pattern. That's also one thing that bugs me with the whole Game of Thrones rules. You should have patterns, because if you have a consistent pattern, you can know one case and then extrapolate to the rest. But if you don't have, you have to know every single case separately. And that's just needlessly complicated, like you said.
So I guess the question is there anything they can do about it?
Yeah, would you guys like to see anything in particular added on that sort of front in that next FAQ, which I should clarify for listeners, we are recording this before the April FAQ is released. So, caveat, who knows what might happen.
Right, okay. Yeah, so I got this. So rules, well, there are at least two typos that I think they should fix. And one is Marguerite Tyrell. The text currently reads Marguerite spells M-A-R-G-E-R-Y instead of with the additional letter. So it's a minor typo. Nobody's been playing it wrong. Same thing with Sir Axel Florent. There's a version with two L's and a version with one L. In the book, it's two L's. So minor typo they can fix. And one that someone just pointed out the other day, it turns out the Long Lances is on the restricted list. And the card is called Long Lances. So a lot of people have been playing with no restricted card. Again, these are minor. Nobody's been doing it wrong. But while they're fixing things, this is the kind of thing that they could have there. But the rules clarifications that I was talking about, primarily, they definitely need to codify that new ruling, the Genislint one we were talking about, because we want to see that somewhere official.
That seems like a far-reaching ruling, I just want to mention.
It certainly is. It will change the way a lot of things are played. Especially stuff related to the draw cap and whether or not you can trigger a Valyrian Steel Link if you're a draw cap and things like that. We I still haven't received my version of Spoils of War, sadly, but I've looked at the insert from somebody else, and it looks like the clarification for gaining prize keywords and losing prize keywords isn't very clear. It's almost certainly going to work exactly like other qualified keywords, but for instance, I'd like to know if you have two copies of prize one, do you resolve them each separately? Or do they stack for some reason? Is this a new precedent where two copies of prize one is one prize two? I assume that's not the case, but we don't have an official ruling in that capacity.
Yeah, I mean, that would be good to know. I think it was you that had mentioned the joking prize 15 and infamous thing earlier, right?
Yeah.
You know, if your opponent's at 13 power and you have a card with prized one and prized one and an infamous in hand, it matters whether those two power are claimed separately, right?
Yeah. Nope. Well, somewhat in that they're both passive and they'll both resolve before the infamous.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
But
fair enough.
It would matter whether those keywords stack. So it's possible that having prized one, it doesn't matter how many iterations you have, just like stealth.
Okay.
Or immune to events. It matters because if you lose a keyword, you'd still have a copy of it. But maybe two copies of prized one just means your opponent gets one power when the card dies because you have the keyword prized one.
That makes sense.
And that's something that we do not have a ruling for. I think there should be an epic phase flowchart, or at least a clarification of the fact that we cannot declare that there are no player action windows before that. Clarification that we cannot declare additional challenges because that keeps coming up with people trying to use Lucas Blackwood or anything that allows you to declare an additional challenge. And because you can't do that within an existing challenge and there are no player action windows outside the challenge, the fact that you can't. So, I mean, it's been so long, they really need to clarify that epic phase. And I think I only had one more. It's a recent discussion that's come up, and I think Helmut had commented several times on effects being triggered from out of play. Now, a lot of people are familiar with the rulings that, you know, if someone cancels your Khal Drogo, you can just play him again, trigger his response, the core set one, because you're still responding to the same thing, and the limit of one response per trigger per card only applies to things in play. Because there's no way of verifying that your opponent doesn't have three copies of Khal Drogo in his hand.
Mm-hmm. Unless
However,
you call the judge over like you would need to do for search
right.
effects.
Except that in this case, the rules don't tell you that you can't. So the standing ruling is that essentially you can trigger these out-of-play effects indefinitely until they succeed, so there's really no point in canceling them.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you specifically wanted to kneel your Alanis or whatever the other factions would be. But this has come up recently as to whether that applies from any out-of-play state or only from out-of-play states which are unknown to your opponent. So, for instance, if your Royal Entourage is in your discard pile and you play a Lord or Lady and then you trigger the Royal Entourage and he cancels it, can you trigger that same Royal Entourage again?
Ah.
And by the current ruling, you could because it's an out-of-play state. But the reasoning for it isn't as solid because you can clearly identify without calling out a judge that the same card is being triggered. So it doesn't really matter which way they rule this, but it would be nice to know.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Oh, I did actually have one more, though, and it comes entirely from the article, the Quill and Tankard's Regular, where you guys got a chance to spoil Show of Force. I still have no idea how that card works. I'd like an FAQ entry clarifying it.
Yeah. Me neither, and I think I wrote the text for it in the article, so I have no idea either. Because it just sets completely new precedents again, and we have no idea what it's doing, really.
But again, I am optimistic, because last time I made one of these for the previous FAQ, I had like 5 or 6 points, and I think all but 2 got addressed, and one of them was the Marguerite Tyrell one. So it's bound to get addressed this time. So I don't know if they're actually reading the boards where I bring these up, or if great minds think alike, and I happen to be a great mind. But I'm optimistic that some of these will get fixed.
I think one more thing is we should have the shadows windows into the flowcharts as well.
I think they are now, aren't they?
Are they? I remember they weren't there for a long time.
They weren't, but I think they got put in about 4.0, but I'm going to double check. So it is as part of the framework. They are in the current version. I don't know exactly when they were introduced, but they're after phase begins, but within the same framework action. It's still confusing because the responses are happening to that before they happen to the plot state. But anyway, they are in the charts.
Ah, yeah, good.
I would have one weird addition. So we have a ruling that if a deadbound event is cancelled, the deadbound is not working.
Mm-hmm.
But if we have priced on it, it will work.
Thank you for bringing this up, Ire.
And we don't have a ruling for Stalwart, and we have a Stalwart event.
We do have a Stalwart event. I don't think anyone has ever played it.
Well,
that's not a reason not to address it. That's just
Greg built a deck once that did use it. I don't remember the whole obscenity, but it had something to do with Pyre of the False Gods and the bottom of the deck, and it was a mess. But I had thought for a long time that there was a standing ruling that if an event, say a Deathbound event like the Prince's Plans, were canceled, keywords on that event did not go off because the entirety of that event resolution is canceled. But now that we have prized out and we have a specific ruling that prized does go off, it just feels really strange for me. Was I just completely imagining things, or was it just one of those common law things that I had just been thinking of for years now, that no keywords would go off when it was canceled, when really that was just an accepted convention that's now been, upset?
Well, yeah, I think it was specific to Deathbound. There's a specific ruling that says if Deathbound is canceled, it still goes through. So that's the extension of that to all keywords is no great stretch, and I can see why you would have done that, and I did that too until I saw that prized insert.
Yeah.
But it was never stated that way. And I think maybe the difference here is that prized is the cost of playing the effect. Right there, I mean, no, never mind.
I was going to say, it's not really worded as a cost.
No,
but
it's not.
It just feels kind of like that player action window at the start of phase thing. Like, it doesn't matter to me too much which way FFG goes as a whole, but I would rather we have a consistent ruling on how keywords on events work.
Yeah, again, we need a pattern for this, I think. Something that is consistent between them in some way.
I suspect that in both cases it was sort of a stopgap measure. Someone's complaining about Forever Burning and the fact that they can't get rid of it, and they go, okay, no, actually, if you cancel it, then it will go to the discard pile and they won't be able to get it back. And now you're looking at prize and you're going, well, hold on, there has to be some cost to running this prize 3 event, some risk to it, because the effect is so powerful. So make it so that if my opponent cancels it, then, and they're treating it separately for balance reasons rather than together for consistency's sake.
But I think they're doing that quite a bit, making the rules twist in a way to keep game balance working. But I think I'd rather have the cards errated so that they're actually doing what you want them to do instead of just saying that they do it.
I agree with that, I think.
I think one of the ones that always bothered me quite a bit was to be a stag and to be a dragon, because the text was never changed on those, but they added this separate rule to them, which said they cannot be triggered if you don't have the corresponding targets in your dead and discard pile. Well, the wording they have and what remains there actually would claim the exact opposite.
Which is interesting in light of that Janice Slint ruling, because if that now will be the ruling as a whole going forward, that would bring the rest of the rules in line with those to be events, right?
Yes, it would. And that's quite interesting, actually.
So I think that's a pretty far-reaching conversation we've had so far, but I definitely don't want to skip anything if you guys had anything else on your plates.
I had one thing. It's mostly a very minor thing again, but I think it might be interesting to pop up because it came up recently. I'll pose this as a question again. Let's think about two cards, three cards in the game that can give a card immunity to card effects in general. Cattle Canals or Snakeskin Veil or Burning Sword would be the three, I think. Let's pick cattle canals because she's the easiest one. So how does this interact with, let's say, deadly?
Let me get cat specifically in front of me here so I can read cat o' the canals. And let's see, immune to opponent's card effects. I'm tempted to say that she is immune to deadly.
Indeed, she is. How about stealth?
I would be tempted to also include stealth.
Yes, that's true.
Okay.
And this was actually a bit surprising, in a way, because keywords, they aren't card character abilities, but indeed they are card effects, even though, for example, stealth is mentioned in the FAQ flowchart. So it reads there as a separate part, as if it was a game effect, but it actually is a card effect still.
You know, that's interesting you bring that up, and I was mentioning so many things that have flip-flopped over the years. You know, at one point, keywords were a separate thing, then they became character abilities for a couple of years, and then went back to being a separate thing again. So, it's interesting.
It's also one of the first things people stumble onto when they start playing with, for example, corset cards. And that's the first thing that comes, they run into, and then go, that doesn't sound right. Why isn't my immune to character abilities not immune to deadly? Mm-hmm. It's on the character. Why is this happening? And I think that's a funniest thing in a way, because I've seen many new starting players get upset about it. They feel it just doesn't make sense for some reason. I'm so old in a way as a player that I take it as granted, I think. But for them, it seems really counterintuitive, I think.
I mean, I guess we come out as fairly negative here in general because we're the ones who are picking at the nitty-gritty of the rules. It's worth noting that, first of all, FFG does seem to be learning from their mistakes in other games, at least. And the templating is certainly improving. That may not mean much for us right now. But it's also worth noting that despite all this complexity and despite all these problems that we tend to get frustrated with because we'll specifically go look for them on the boards and see them come up all the time, the game is growing. The game keeps growing, and people are still buying and playing the game. So, you know, I think just to keep that in perspective when we're being particularly down like this, that we may see it as something incredibly frustrating, but if you don't interact with it much, the game seems to work.
Yeah, I guess, what would you say? I mean, it's hard to judge, but what? As a rough ballpark, 80% of players or something play a bunch of games in a row and never run into these awkwardness. They just play, you know, a bunch of effects that do work or skip over some of these things that are awkward.
Yeah, and I think one reason we're discussing them negatively is just because it makes a better discussion, you know. It's you don't get a long discussion from jolly, gee, they're doing a good job, aren't they? Aye, they are.
Indeed.
So it's good to remember that always, Will. I think one thing is that it's very specific cards that are making the issues, usually. Like, 90% of the cards really function nicely in the rules framework and do their thing quite clearly, and you know what they're doing. But then there's some problem child, if you will, and those are the ones that usually have to be errated several times and go back and forth on how they should work and stuff like that. And that's also something to keep in mind, I think.
And I think in general, even if we come off as sounding critical, I think we all want this to be constructive criticism. If by some strange chance someone at FFG does listen to this show, you know, we're bringing these up and shedding some light on some of these issues so that they could be, you know, worked on and clarified and improved on.
Yeah, definitely. I'm a firm believer, at least, in making knowledge public and spreading knowledge in a way, because I think the more everybody knows, the better the game becomes, in a way, because if everybody knows the rules correctly and can play the game according to them, we get a much better meta and a much better competitive environment also.
And I think for the painted table this week, Kyle has yet another little tourney recap for us. I think he manages to make it to a lot more of those than Daryl and I.
Yeah, I would say so.
I was in Wayne, Nebraska, which I'm sure no one here has been to, for good reason. No, Wayne was actually really nice, about the size of the town I went to college in. The real attraction, Wayne, is not the school or the booze. It is Mr. Matthew Lay, otherwise known as Rings, the drink master himself. So Rings applied to get a regional and unfortunately was denied. He tries to pair it up with the local sci-fi nerd board game convention that happens on campus, which was this past weekend. And that just happens to fall outside the regional bracket. So he said, you know what? Instead of being discouraged, he bought his own prize support, opened up his home to a bunch of Thronesers, and about 8 people got to go to Wayne and have a kick-ass time playing some cards. So, yeah, the tournament was great. I posted on the page throughout the weekend how, you know, how great it was, and it really was wonderful. The prize support was phenomenal. I took 4th, I think, and nice. Came home with, I don't know if you've seen it, it's this, like, probably 5-foot-long, foot-wide banner of Westeros, and it has all the different house crests on them wherever they are, kind of cartoony.
Oh, sounds awesome.
I'll put a photo of it up, it's pretty sweet. Dana got the Khal Drogo Season 3 mat, very excited that that came home. I was not, but she was. But no, it was good. It was a very good, very good tournament. Let's see. I ran Laney Song of Fire, which I posted, and it did not win. Still has not won a tournament. I got that deck from Elite, from Shides. I changed probably 6 cards in it. But, I mean, it was solid. The thought just being, I'm going to play really beefy, good dudes, and just never be behind. I had a couple slow starts during the day, and that's kind of what did it in for me. Two of my losses came from like 2 card flops. I tend to be very aggressive when I mulligan, and sometimes Lady Luck is with you, and sometimes she's not, and she was not there on Saturday. But Rings did win with Laney No Agenda, very similar. He said it's pretty much the deck he took to World, which was rather akin to kind of the No Agenda of Laney decks we've been seeing. His has a lot more shadows in it. Ran Fear Winners are restricted.
Yeah.
You know, drawing a lot off of Preston, triggering with Preston, that kind of thing. very solid, very Rings kind of deck. Tends to those things that are rather straightforward. Here's the game plan. I'm going to play it, and it pretty much pilots, not really pilots itself, but has a very simple flow to it. Not necessarily a ton of triggers, things like that. Which I'm starting to more and more I've been playing, I kind of agree with his thought there. Because if you're worrying about every little piece of your combo and making sure all these little engines and micro combos are going off and whatnot, you can sometimes get bogged down, or as the day goes on, start forgetting things, your play gets sloppy, so you can tell he really gets to focus on like a higher level of thinking and strategy when he's playing. And the deck very much so lends itself to that. So, good deck, great player. Obviously, he's a world champion, and it shows. I watched the top cut after I got knocked out, and, you know, just he's super solid play. You never see a play mistake out of him. Super nice about it, even when he's crushing you.
Yep. One card.
Yeah.
With a smile
second
on his face.
And that stupid I dominate. You in dominance, but he dominates. Oh,
I dominate. Yeah. So I dominate. Yep. Yes, yep. He does.
Number 2 was the drunk Justin Fox. piloting a House of Dreams Bear Island deck that Rings had built.
Wait, you say Justin Fox was there?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
He has never missed a Nebraska.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I miss that guy.
He flew in.
It was good.
Wow. Wow. And he got second with Bear Island?
With Bear Island.
Look at that. That guy never plays, still a good player.
Yeah. Very nice. I don't know how he does it.
Man, he knows his Stark, man.
He does. He, like, something about that house just clicks. Whether he's seen the cards before in his life or not.
Wasn't even his deck. That wasn't even his deck. Rings built it. Said play it. He looked through it. Did his thing. So very good. Ben Terpstra took third with Dragon Pit. The deck that very much so is up and coming, and you can see I've yet to see it wipe the board of three strengths with Aegon out there on a threat turn, but I'm sure it's coming. And then I took four. So a nice blue deck, very strong. Normally when eight man you hear about an eight man tournament, you worry about quality of play or you know, how representative things are, but and there are four people there that have all either won regionals or at least performed very well at major tournaments.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
so, it was a good game.
Just to throw that out there, because I think Fox's name isn't mentioned much other than, you know, when we say it here on the show. And then it's generally just for our disbelief at his performance. I want to point out that the man has top four at Worlds. He top eighted, I think it was, last year, the year before.
Mm-hmm. I believe it was the year before.
At Gen Con. And is the only man I've ever seen win a regional first turn of the title game.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have not forgotten about you, Foxy.
And he hasn't either. We should bring him back on one of these days. I kind of mentioned that to him, so
he's just a busy guy, man.
He is. He's moving and shaking.
Yep.
But no, so it was a good tournament. It was really good. Couple games. After playing, I'm not sure I'm quite a believer that Song of Fire is the way to go. If Kings of Summer wasn't, it's not good enough to be a restricted card. But I think I would honestly go that route over Song of Fire. Because the more I think about it, yeah, the Song of Ice would hurt it a lot. But the thing people forget is you can still make it quote-unquote summer. It's just not summer, but it's not winter either. So you can have that Black Raven out. You still count one additional gold, just none of your summer effects trigger.
Right,
so you
kind
of splash it in there. And I'll post the deck list before this post on Friday. People can see a lot of the effects are just kind of gravy on top, Tommen, things like that are nice.
I was wanting to ask you, how was that Tommen for you?
Pretty good. Running that with Pyros is really nice because you can pull one that you want and then set up your next two, trigger that, draw them. Mm-hmm. If you don't like what you're seeing, I've got two Lion Heralds in there. So you can shuffle it all away if it's a problem. Let's see what else. But, I mean, there were a couple games. I would say three out of four games I would hit the four-card draw cap.
Nice.
A lot of kings, a lot of queens, Marjorie, Cersei, again, the Tommen, the Joff where you put the gold on him when they marshal. So a decent number of kings and queens trigger that with key. Really speeds it up. No golden tooth mines. But it's really aggressive. If you ever played Shives, his decks are always very aggressive, very character-centric. And this definitely did that. I mean, it's all about board presence and muscling around your opponent. And that's what it did. It runs the fleet, one of King Joffrey's guards, King's Landing Guard, just with a big DV army to do things. I'd almost be tempted to run it no agenda so you get the brigands, but I don't know. That might be pushing it.
I mean, the brigands are pretty really awesome.
And I don't know how much you really need the fourth card, but that was how it was given to me, and I'm a big believer. And I hate people that they ask for a deck list or borrow a deck, and then before they play any games with it, just change 8-10 cards and 2 blocks. It's like, play the deck, learn the deck, see it in action, figure out why these decisions were made. Don't have to agree with them, but at least see, like, why the deck is the way it is. Play it as it was envisioned, right. And then
yeah.
Make it your own.
Make an educated disagreement.
There you go.
People too often, I think, go, oh, I don't like this card, and this card. Rip it out. It's like, well, play the game.
Right.
And see. And,
right. Get a feel for the synergy.
Yeah, and you don't know. Like, obviously, especially someone like Shive or someone you trust that's a quality deck builder, they put some time and thought into every card. They didn't just blindly throw something in there. And there are things that he changed. He handed me and he goes, Pastor Redwine, is that his name? Paxter?
Redwine, yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Was in there and he goes, he's crap, take him out.
Yeah, I've never really been a big fan.
He only got to play like 3 or 4 games before he gave it to me. He's like, here's the idea, here's what I'm going for. Go from there. And a lot of it involved trying to compete with the fleet to like stand the brothel guards during a challenge or use Marjorie to throw someone in and then drop the fleet in for the deadly. Some cuter little tricksy things. There are some things I would change not having played it, but it was fun. I mean, it was solid. I played a pickup games with Rings afterwards that did not go as expected, but I hung in there a lot better than I thought I would. Got some resilience to it, but I think it's kind of where the game is going to be heading, I think, is back towards a quality character base and having quality board position being an emphasis over control or taking things out of the challenge phase. I would be very shocked if the theme coming out of this FAQ was not to put things back in a kind of what you envision Thrones, the Thrones game that you teach to friends. About making challenges and doing challenges and having characters out that are better than their characters out.
Mm-hmm.
So
you think that the character efficiency is going to be a bigger role going forward? Is that what you mean? Or?
I think it's always been a big role. I think just as the game has evolved and the competition level has increased, the word efficiency is something that's getting tossed on a higher echelon discussion a lot more. Before, and we're getting to the point where you can be choosy in that way. Before, there were times to make your theme work or to make your idea work, you were stuck with, because you got to have 30 characters in a deck at least, usually, maybe 25, maybe 35. So you're like, I got to fill those slots, and these are the cards that barely make us have enough characters that work. I mean, I remember talking at regionals and tournaments, like, we just got this pack, and it just gave me another non-unique, so I can finally run a somewhat decent character count to make this idea work. And now I think we have a card pool that's long and large enough that, okay, I can totally make this intrigue-heavy rush deck or this army deck or whatever have you work. I can start being choosy on who's going in here, what makes the cut, what makes this the best version of itself. And you can start playing with cards and comparing them on a more intimate level. And that's why I think efficiency is becoming more of a topic, is because you can finally be choosy on, okay, well, I don't know what a really good example is. Like, let's say this, you have some big, stupid army. What's a big, dumb Landish army? Like, go King's Landing Guard versus the Brigands. Okay, both are 4 cost, 5 strength. But the Brigand's ability lets me use it multiple times. This is obviously a more efficient card than necessarily the King's Landing Guard. But that's an argument and discussion you get to have now, because in earlier Thrones, you only had one of those 2 cards, if even that, and you were just lucky to have it. So, yeah, I think efficiency will continue to be a more and more important thing. And as this card pool gets bigger and bigger, being able to squeeze the most impact out of those 60 cards going to become more and more important, because the power level across the board is going to become much more significant. And as a result of that, you're going to have to find more and more creative ways to push your deck over the top.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can definitely tell with just some of the cards that we've already seen come out of that, just that first pack of the cycle, you know, those characters are Even, some are prized, but man, incredibly efficient for, cost versus their ability themselves. So I see what you're saying.
Seems like every week now I'm having these 3 to 5 minute soapbox rants. I realized afterwards, I'm like, I just went on a huge thing.
You did. I was looking for a yes or a no, but it's fine.
I mean, that's okay, Kyle. You got your opinion out there. Folks know what you think, and, maybe by the time this episode airs, people will know whether that is true or not, or maybe they'll have to wait till the next week. We don't know yet.
Bum, bum, bum.
If one person feels like they learned something or agreed with me or passionately disagreed, then that's probably success in my book.
It's all good.
Props and slops.
Flop 'em and prop 'em.
I mean, I've got a pretty big prop I want to throw out there because I watched Captain America 2, The Winter Soldier, this last Friday, and it was rocking. I'm not sure if I'm ready to declare it my favorite Marvel movie yet, but I really, really enjoyed it. I think I would like to see it again.
Nice. Well, I have a prop. It's something I propped last week, but I'm again going to prop True Detective. I finished the series, or season one at least, just today, and it was excellent. It was very nice. I immediately Googled season two to see what may or may not be in the works for that, and I won't give away any spoilers or anything like that. If you haven't watched the show, you should watch it. It's very delicious.
Cool.
Let's see. I don't really have a prop. I mean, it's a pretty cool week. But other than Rings, obviously that's a huge prop. Beyond, probably one of the best, if not the best, hosts in Thrones. Just opened his home to us. Opened his liquor cabinet, more importantly. We played Drunk Quest. Props to Drunk Quest. That game was phenomenal.
I wanted to play that.
Me too.
It's kind of like Munchkin with a crap ton of booze.
Wasn't that like on Kickstarter?
On you, it gets pretty rough. Yeah.
Okay.
I believe it was a Kickstarter originally.
And Rings love him some Kickstarter.
Boy, does he. Yeah.
So Fox decided to pick on me, and I got pretty shitty, say the least. It was a great time. It was fun. Slop to me and tech support, or my own tech support. I tried to fix I had a faulty driver. I wasn't sure which driver was faulty, and I used Windows Verifier. And the end result, because I'm an idiot and didn't do a backup, was a non-bootable computer. So it would instantly be thawed the moment the Windows screen showed up. So it was a lot of fun. But we have a fresh install. I got that new computer OS smell.
I do always enjoy that.
That has been my weekend, is reinstalling drivers and all of that fun.
Nice.
So who?
Well, I've got another prop. This one, bizarrely, is going to be to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. because the last few episodes have actually been getting okay. I'm not going to say they're great, but okay. And then we hit the episode that played the Tuesday before Cap was released on Friday, and things suddenly had a very direct connection. I mean, there's a character who leaves to go do one thing during that episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and then we pick up with them probably hours, possibly a day or two, or very, very quickly at least, later with that character early on in Captain America 2, which I thought was awesome. And then this last Tuesday, the first one after Cap came out, that continued to fall out, and there were more callbacks and more direct connections to what's going on in the movie. And I think finally they've kind of gotten the show to where it needs to be. I'm still not absolutely sure if that justifies the early dead episodes we had, but it's starting to get pretty cool, and the ability to start weaving that story through the films and the TV show and back and forth is actually pretty freaking awesome. And this last episode actually had like three twists that kept you guessing, so it was good. It has improved a lot from where it started.
Nice. I have a slop, which is to my lack of knowledge of flying. Earlier today, I spent probably half an hour trying to figure out what all I'm allowed to take on a plane and what counts as carry-on. And I just found out that you can take carry-on, one carry-on and one personal item, like a purse or a bag of some kind. Mm-hmm. So I did not know that you could do that. So luckily I won't have to cram everything into one bag. Because I have this horrible fear of checking my luggage or something and then it getting lost.
Ooh,
so
yeah.
So I'm going to take everything on the plane.
Got anything else, Kyle?
Yeah, I'll give one for Danny. The new Kickstarter for Super Dungeon Explorer has been extremely lucrative for us. You can still get in on that. I think it's $100 and essentially buys you the whole game. And then they have a stretch goal, some of which you have to, you can buy as additional, but a lot of it is free. I mean, just tokens on tokens and all kinds of new heroes and mini bosses, and just, it's nuts the kind of free stuff they're giving out. I'm sure we've made up $100 just in the stuff that we get for free on top of it. Pretty cool game, kind of like a casual dungeon crawl. I think it's kind of this very 8-bit, 16-bit world kind of style, very cool. Fun. I enjoy the game. It's a lot of fun. So if someone's looking for a new game, they feel like Kickstartering, go look up Super Dungeon Explorer by Soda Pop. Soda Pop? Cool Mini or not? One of the two.
I'm pretty sure it's Soda Pop. Soda Pop. Is it Soda Pop or Pop Cap?
Soda Pop.
Okay.
Well, I also have one left. Maybe not a game, but a fun event. Over the weekend, Chris and I also did a color run, which was the first organized run I'd been on. Not really a race, it was a run, not timed or anything. But it was a blast, and I think it may have hooked me. I think I'm going to be looking forward to doing more. I don't think I can really let guests onto the show without giving them the opportunity to prop and or slop anything. So I hope I'm not springing this on you guys in too much of a last-minute scenario. But do any of you have anything you'd like to prop or slop?
I could start with a little bit of brown-nosing and prop 2-Chance 1-Chomp for your 500th like.
Why, thank you. Thank you. Felt like we had to poke a little innocent fun at you guys for pushing to get that 100th like earlier.
Oh, yeah. No, it was good.
I think I would like to prop the Finnish meta for having a pretty nice store championship a few weeks ago here in Kuopio, and people traveled from 400 to 500 kilometers away, that was like 200 to 300 miles away, to come here in the middle of nowhere to play, and we had a pretty good tourney, and I liked it quite a bit.
Yeah. You know, at one point we were going to attempt this a little closer to that tournament, so you could fill us in a little bit more. But if you have any salient points from it, feel free to throw them in.
Mm-hmm. I think we had a pretty interesting tourney because we had several classic competitive decks there, but we also had some more offbeat decks, with the final being Baratheon New Agenda against my Stark Hollow Hill, which I call the Murder Hill. It's a fun deck. I wouldn't say it's a really top-tier competitive deck, but it's a fun deck at least. And it was an interesting tourney with good games. So, yeah, that's, I guess, what most of that I want to say about
it. Ire, anything on your end?
I guess I'll take the Daryl position here and prop a game for a chance.
Sure.
So I'm giving props to Rogue Legacy, a game which I bought from Steam sale a few months ago. Just now got to play it, and I have really liked it.
I recognize that name. What kind of game is it?
It's indie platformer where you take a role of different kind of knights, and they die horribly, and then you get new heirs who try to do better than their fathers.
Oh, okay.
And this is probably not proper, but I would give slaps to Skype and Alexander Hines' photo in it.
Because I look so happy sailing and...
No, this is somehow pixelating it so that your eyes look like they are bleeding. This is real nightmare food.
Ooh, while we're talking about games, I want to prop Age of Wonders 3 for being the crack cocaine of computer games.
Oh, is that an RTS?
No, it's a really old school strategy game. Like, the world map thing is a bit like Heroes of Might and Magic, in a way. But the combat is strategic hex-based combat. And it's just a new game. It's a really old game that I played a lot in my youth, and it's just number 3 just came out, and it's horribly addicting.
I guess I have another prop, which I think really deserves mentioning, because a lot of people have been complaining about the metagame nowadays and how it's gone to these greater stall effects and pulled further away from challenges, and I entirely agree. But over the last 3 weeks, the tournaments that have been submitted to the database, there's been a massive shift, and whether it's because people are bored of those decks and just moving on to other things, trying things that they think won't get hit by the FAQ, or whether it's the answers against that slow metagame, but Rush is back, and the metagame deserves props, because Rush keeps control honest, and I'm so glad to see tournaments being won, or, you know, strong presences by Rush decks.
Yeah, you know, I think I will kind of second that sort of props, and, you know, just kind of extend that to the community as a whole, because, you know, the meta is always shifting and adapting, and, you know, sometimes things are still too strong and get addressed via the FAQ in one way or another, but I think with the combined brain power we have available to us now, and the shared information, I mean, the community is active online like I have never seen before in my years of the game. And, you know, when you get enough people trying to crack those kind of problems, that target shifts rapidly. So it's very interesting to watch.
And since we have too many props, I'll add a slop, and that's to the third book of the Mistborn series, after dredging through the second. And the third's pacing is basically identical to the second. I think this may be one of the first trilogies in a long time that I just don't finish.
Ah, so you're reading that now? See, I think you should finish it just so that we can talk about what you think of the ending. I definitely thought each book took a step down as they went, and then I felt that the ending... this may turn you off from reading it completely, I don't know, but I felt like the ending was a little too childish for Sanderson's writing. It just felt very forced to me. Things get bad, get bad, get bad, and flip a switch, here's the answer.
Some sort of Deus Ex.
Yeah.
I mean, in general, I seem to appreciate Sanderson more when he's writing at the young adult level as Steelhearts, for instance.
Ooh,
I think
it's
very much up his alley, and at the right level, and written quite well. I think Wave Kings was good. It had pacing issues as well, but it was an example of more mature writing that was also quite good. But Mistborn has been a slug fest, or, you know, it's really quite sluggish from the entry to book 2 onwards.
Oh, that bothers me, because I just bought the whole trilogy a week ago and haven't started it yet.
It is certainly worth reading the first book. I really, really enjoyed the first book, for sure. Well, guys, thank you so very much for agreeing to come be on the show, particularly Alex, for coming on to a competing podcast and helping us out. Iyer, Drakey, thanks for taking a little time off to come over here and retread some of the issues that you already cover in your wonderful Quill and Tankard regulars articles on CardGameDB. I'm just very appreciative we were finally able to get everyone's schedules to line up to accomplish this.
And I think I should thank you for organizing this whole thing, because it was a really good thing, I think, to reach a wider audience on some of the issues we discussed here.
Thanks for listening to another fine episode of Two Champs and a Chump. If you ever want to hit us up, you can email us at twochampsonechump@gmail.com. Like our Facebook page, which is now over 500 likes, so thank you very much. We appreciate you. It really means a lot to us. Whenever we first started this, we weren't sure how big it was going to get, and 500 likes is fantastic. I hope we get 500 more. But you can like us at facebook.com/twochampsonechump. Those are the best ways to get a hold of us. Google Plus is still a thing. You know, subscribe to our Twitch page, twitch.tv/twochampsonechump. Eventually, we're going to really start doing something with that, just not quite yet. We have a YouTube channel, but it doesn't really matter, because we'll probably never put anything on there. Is that it?
I think that's pretty much it, though I'd also say be on the lookout for updates to Daryl, or updates from Daryl, rather, while he's at PAX.
There you go.
Because I'm going to be demanding that he post information.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to be all over it. My Twitter will be all the buzz, as well as I'll be posting things from my personal Facebook. And, of course, anything that's remotely relevant to Thrones or anything like that, or at least card game related, I will be posting on the Facebook page of Two Champs, One Chump. So we're going to have a blast, or at least I am, because I'll be over there going to Boston. I'm going to do a lot of fantastic stuff. So I'm very excited. I'm also scared of flying a little.
I'm sure you won't die in a fiery crash.
Nah, it's fine. You know, more people die from vending machines landing on them.
Yeah.
So exactly. As long as there's not a vending machine on that plane, because then we're just doubling our odds for disaster.
Yeah, there's that.
It'll Danger zone? I tried to say danger zone with a question mark. Danger zone?
You succeeded.
No?
Damn it, Kyle. It's your fault. Danger zone. Titties and the great big mill in the sky. How you turn around and there's jizz in your eye. The great big mill in the sky. That didn't even make sense.
That is an amazing Easter egg. Thank you, Daryl.